afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You've just seen the website of the International Organization Migration, and the last page you've seen is actually the stock of migrants who's coming into Australia and going out of Australia. So it's interesting data analysis that International Organization for Migration, IOM, is doing. My name is Ji Young Song. I'm a research fellow and director of migration and border policy here at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. I joined early this year, January 2016, as someone who can bring in a new, fresh perspective from Asia on Australia's migration and immigration policy. As you can hear from my dodgy accent, I spent some time in the UK for my education and Singapore for my employment for the past 10 years, so excuse my dodgy accent. I think I've been moving around for the same reason that millions of other migrants have been moving around. Today we have Dr. Frank Latko, who is the director of IOM Global Migration Data Analysis Center based in Berlin. He previously was based in Geneva, leading IOM's Migration Research Division, and he's the co-chair of the Data and Research Group and the Migration Global Migration Group, and he's also an editor of IOM Springer Global Migration Book Series, as well as the co-editor of Migration Policy Practice. Among many interesting publications he has led in the past years include the World Migration Report 2013, Fatal Journeys, Tracking Lives Lost During Migration, and How the World View Migration, Europe's Migration Crisis, Making Sense of the Numbers, which is very important for someone who's been studying migration for many years. Understanding the scale and the nature and the characteristics of global migration is very important. He can talk about it after we cover our major topic for today, which is the 2016 Global Report for Migrant Smuggling. Before I go to the report itself, I'd like to give you some background about the International Organization for Migration, IOM. IOM was established in 1951 as an intergovernmental committee for European migration to help resettle people displacement by World War II. So it was basically starting as a European institution, intergovernmental institution, but now it has become an international one, IOM. It's an intergovernmental organization, as I said. The members are governments, not private actors. And as of April 2015, the IOM has 162 member states and 9 observer states. You've seen the background at the IOM website. It has a number of publications in recent years, including the Global Migration Trends. Let me just give you a very short snapshots of what's happening around the world on global migration. In 2015, last year, the number of international migrants worldwide, the people residing in a country other than their country of origin, like myself, and many like you, the children of migrants, was the highest ever recorded at 244 million. It was up from 232 million in 2013, so it was the highest number of migrants moving across national borders last year. The world hosted 15 million refugees by mid-2015. This was 45% increase compared to 3.5 years ago, and largely because of the continued conflict in Syria, and some 5 million people were newly displaced in the first half of last year. Last year was also the deadliest year for migrants. Over 5,400 migrants worldwide were estimated to have died or gone missing last year. Last year also had a number of voluntary migrants. For some of my colleagues here who's been working on voluntary and forced return migration, the number of voluntary returns migration from EU countries, sorry about the very EU-centric context, was for the first time higher than the number of forced returns. There is a question mark about whether voluntary is really voluntary, you know, whether it's assisted voluntary or induced voluntariness of return migration. There's a moral dilemma in there. The number of IOM assisted voluntary returns from EU member states, Norway and Switzerland in last year reached almost 56,000. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Latsko, today's main speaker. Let me ask you the first question about your center, IOM Berlin Data Analysis Center.
Okay, good morning or good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you to the Lowy Institute and to Ji Yong Song for this great invitation. Yes, IOM is actually 65 years old today. This year, sorry about it's the jet lag. It's 65 years of age this year. And the big change that's likely to happen in this year is that finally perhaps IOM will join the UN system officially, although we've been working very closely with the UN system for many years. Now, you may be surprised to know that although we're 65 years of age, we didn't until about a year ago produce an annual IOM statistics report. And this is just one example of how IOM as an organization hasn't really fully made the best use of the data that it collects. IOM has actually more than doubled in size in the last 10 years as an organization. And we implement nearly 3,000 projects around the world each year. So every time we assist a migrant, we collect a lot of information about the activities or services that we're providing. But a lot of this information is scattered across different countries, across different parts of the organization. So one of the reasons why our Director General thought it would be a good idea to have a dedicated data center in IOM is to help us understand and to explain to the outside world in a more maybe consistent fashion, you know, what are some of the key achievements of IOM. But also, we wanted to be able to provide a much better service to the outside world. As the leading intergovernmental agency in the international migration field, we receive requests every single day of the week, every week of the year, about global migration issues, global migration trends. There is a huge appetite for information and particularly data and data analysis about international migration. As migration has risen to the top of the global policy agenda for many countries and regions of this world. So the idea of creating a data analysis center was our response to these growing requests from different quarters, different stakeholders across the world for information, the latest information, the latest analysis about what's going on in the migration field. Perhaps one last word. We spend a lot in our business. We spend a lot of time going to conferences, and there are many global conferences, international conferences on migration. And one of the easiest things that governments can agree upon at these conferences, we need better data. We need better evidence. So that you'll often find you find a chairman's conclusion or a conference conclusion which says, yes, we need better data. Okay, we agree on that. But rarely do you find or see a blueprint for action. You rarely see governments coming together and saying, okay, we're going to do 1, 2, 3. These are the things that we're going to do. This is the action we're going to take to improve data on migration. So one of the reasons why IOM set up this center was also to engage more with the policy world to try and make the case for better data, better evidence on migration. Because we think that the reason why we have many knowledge gaps is partly because we lack maybe the technical capacities to gather information in very difficult parts of the world where data may not be easily available. But also there is a lack of political engagement, lack of political will for many countries. Migration, collecting information about migration may not be a top priority. But there are also sensitivities. Governments may not want to share the information that they collect. So maybe that's as much as I'll say on the center. We have a website. You can find out much more information about the center and what it does.
So it sounds
online.
Like your center is not just collecting and analyzing the big data on migration, but also making those data publicly more accessible and more from user friendly for not just the policymakers, but also general audience like us today.
Well, we highlighted, when we launched the centre last September in Berlin with our Director General, we highlighted the importance of communicating about data more effectively. And that is one of the goals of the centre. And to give you a very recent example, last week, June 20th, was World Refugee Day. And if you saw the BBC's website, the BBC announced we have more refugees in the world than ever before, 60 million plus. Well, that's not quite right. Yes, we have more forcibly displaced people around the world, but most of them are internally displaced. They're living within their own country. Only a minority of those forcibly displaced are refugees. Now, you may think that's just a nuance, that's not important, but it is important in which it's important how we present data, because there are different responsibilities when we talk about refugees and when we talk about internally displaced persons. And when you talk about refugees, often in certain parts of the world, there is a suggestion or a fear that maybe because they're refugees, they might be potentially heading in our direction. Mm-hmm. So that's just one recent example. But there are much worse examples of how the media misrepresents data on migration.
That's why having your centre is important. We just had a closed-door workshop 2 days ago with our partners at the Department of Immigration and Border Protection. And one of the questions was, why data is important? Why do we need to understand data? Can understanding data produce better policy to tackle the migration or migrant or refugee crisis? How would you answer to that question?
Well, my answer to that is that data in itself is not an answer, but it can help you to get to an answer. I mean, you need to know the basic facts and figures about the numbers of migrants, where they're coming from, where they're going to, if you're going to engage in a meaningful discussion about migration policy. But having those numbers doesn't tell you what kind of policy necessarily you're going to adopt. Some countries want to attract certain kinds of migrants or have a more generous policy towards refugees than others. Having the numbers in itself doesn't tell you what kind of policy the government is planning to introduce. But without having those basic numbers or a basic understanding of migration, then you're making policy in a vacuum, and that's not good either.
That's also what's happening in Australia as well. The humanitarian migration is a very small portion of the entire migration program of Australia. It's less than 7%, but because some media or some far-right groups are exaggerating the scale, the scope of humanitarian migration, most people understand that it's a big part of the Australia's official migration program, which is not true. 66% of the Australian's migration program are actually focusing on economic skilled migration, not humanitarian migration. So understanding data and the exact scale of the crisis is very important. Can we now move on to the 2016 TCR's global report on migrant smuggling? Can you just give us a definition of smuggling, people smuggling and human trafficking? Because that's sometimes the mixed terminology and conceptualization in the media.
Okay. Well, I can't give you there are legal definitions based on the Palermo protocols, but I think the key point to make about the definition of there are 3 points maybe. First of all, there has always been a sharp distinction made between the definition of trafficking and the definition of smuggling, and that has often given us the world has often had the impression that people who are involved in trafficking are victims, they're subject to exploitation, etc., and they're distinct from people who voluntarily choose a smuggler and decide to move to a country, often perhaps maybe for economic reasons. Well, the reality is that those streams of people tend to overlap, and people who move with the assistance of smugglers are often very vulnerable and often highly at risk. And one of the reasons, and one of the key reasons why our organization decided to prepare a global report on migrant smuggling is because we are increasingly concerned about the risks and the vulnerabilities and the human rights abuses that migrants face on these dangerous journeys around the world. And we wanted to call attention to that in our global report. There is an annual report on trafficking persons. In fact, there are two annual reports, global reports on trafficking persons, one produced by the UN, one produced by the US State Department. There is no such thing as a global annual report on migrant smuggling. There have been periodic reports from time to time by different organizations. The international community has paid a lot of attention to the subject of trafficking, and there is a great deal of concern, quite rightly, about the exploitation and abuse of people who get caught up in trafficking rings. But we perhaps have not focused enough on the migrants who suffer terrible abuses, and not least, in some cases, death. You mentioned some figures at the beginning of this session. Our organization started collecting data on migrant deaths in a systematic way 2 years ago, and we've just released our second global report entitled Fatal Journeys. And there we calculated that over the last 20 years, at least 60,000 migrants around the world have perished during their journeys. And in the last 2.5 years since the Lampedusa tragedy off the in the Mediterranean Sea, where nearly 400 migrants died, something like 10,000 migrants have died in the Mediterranean region. So these are quite shocking figures. Now, last year, it's estimated that 90% of the migrants who crossed the Mediterranean at some point in their journey used the services of smugglers. So the death toll is linked also to migrant smuggling. So our approach was, in preparing this global report on migrant smuggling, was to try and see, to understand better migrant smuggling more from the perspective of migrants. And we tried to review the research and the data that exists across 11 different regions of the world. And as you know, you were one of the experts who contributed to this report. We did this work in about 6 months. We held a first workshop last December in Istanbul. And I think this is perhaps the most comprehensive, up-to-date, global overview of data and research on migrant smuggling. And the report is due to be released in August of this year.
Well, are we right to understand both human trafficking and people smuggling are criminal acts, but trafficking involves some sort of form of exploitation in the destination country, whereas the smuggling ends at the border. And also, trafficking can happen both internally and transnationally, whereas the smuggling is only for transnational activities.
Yeah, these sorts of definitions and distinctions have been made over the years. I think where there is controversy is that there isn't necessarily a standard definition of what we mean by human smuggling or migrant smuggling. Even the European definition is now slightly different from the Palermo Protocol, because it says that you can be smuggled on humanitarian grounds. So it makes an exception there. And it also now, in 9 of the European Union member states, you are now given a temporary residence permit if you're prepared to give evidence against a migrant smuggler. So we're seeing, and that's a new change. So we're seeing, and that is something that was done in the trafficking field, which we're now seeing adopted in the migrant smuggling field, that approach.
Yeah, so there's a mixed terminology between trafficking and smuggling, but also there is a mixed conceptualization between asylum seeking or refugees and smuggling, because it used to be two totally different field of migration. One's forced migration, the other is illegal slash irregular migration. Now, refugees are smuggled. Some refugees smuggle themselves. So there's a new word, new jargon called self-smuggling. Smuggling, perhaps we can cover this in a later on, but the evolution of migrant smuggling methodology is also quite significant. It used to be done by all criminal gangs, but these days it's more business model and more entrepreneurial, these smugglers. Recent years, we see the trends of altruistic smugglings. So the smugglings are not done by either criminals or profit-minded people, but also by the religious groups, so they're not really seeking for profit, but for more humanitarian ground. Would you like to add anything onto that sort of evolution of migrant smuggling methodologies?
Well, look, I'll tell you, one of the surprising things about this report was that you read a lot about migrant smuggling in the media. It receives a great deal of policy attention. Most policy makers, if they're planning to address migrant smuggling, will say we need to use the best available data and evidence. But when you scour the world and you look at how much research is available, how much data has been collected, it's remarkably thin. Most of the research, for example, is small-scale research, often carried out by junior scholars. You have very few large-scale surveys of in this area. There was an analysis done, I think, of some 250 studies in Asia recently, and I think only about six of them were based on surveying large numbers of people. So it's a difference between, let's say, talking to 10 people versus talking to 1,000 people about how they were smuggled. And then when it comes to data on this subject, most of the countries around the world are collecting a fairly limited amount of information, or at least the information that is in the public domain is fairly limited and often not that useful. We were surprised when we prepared our report that some countries even don't have official statistics. Apparently, our expert from the United States told us that the US does not publish official statistics on the number of people apprehended for migrant smuggling, which we found quite astonishing. But if you look around the world, most countries will provide you with some basic information, perhaps about the number of smugglers apprehended each year, although those figures are difficult to interpret because countries have different definitions of what they mean by smuggling. But that is really just the tip of the iceberg. That is just the very small number of people who are apprehended and who are caught up in smuggling operations. So we have a fairly poor knowledge of this subject. I have to say, however, that Australia has taken the lead in sponsoring research in this area and also working with governments to try and promote better data collection. Australia has been working with countries in the Asia Pacific region to try to encourage them to collect data on human smuggling in a more systematic way, and has offered training and support to those countries. And Australia has a very innovative research program. Surprisingly, many governments working in the migration field do not have their own dedicated research programs. Australia has for some time had a program focusing on irregular migration, sponsoring research on migrant smuggling. And a distinctive feature of Australia's program is that it has been funding some large-scale research in the Asia-Pacific region. And that is unusual. When you look around the world, there are not many governments that do that.
You're right to point out the difficulties in getting data on migrant smuggling, because unlike other regular migrant migration program in economy or family migration, there's no official record of migrant smuggling, because the nature of migrant smuggling is very clandestine. It's not recorded. People who are smuggled or even trafficked, they don't normally report to the authority. how they smuggle their migration routes. So it's an extremely difficult area for from a researcher's perspective. If I can give you my own anecdote, because you pointed out there is very few survey data on migrant smuggling in this part of the world, in East Asia, in Asia Pacific in particular. I had to follow the physically the footsteps of smuggled migrants or the smugglers themselves. So I follow one of their migrant smuggling route as a as a researcher, but more like an undercover journalist. So I followed one of their route, and it was not as scary or repressive. The route itself was looked after by some female smugglers who are looking after your health and shelter and food. So there is a mixture of gender roles in the entire process of migrant smuggling. It's not like some criminal gangs are repressing them into the confines of their homes. It's not like that. So that was my question about the evolution of smugglers' technique. It's no longer the done by criminals or profit-minded people, but also done by some humanitarian or altruistically minded people.
Well, there are two schools of thought about how migrant smuggling is organized. On the one hand, it's said that much smuggling is based on the so-called pay-as-you-go principle, that migrants will pay what they can for, on each step of the journey, and where they end up may be determined by how much they can afford and which kind of smuggler they come into contact with. And smuggling may be a loose arrangement involving a range of different people. And it may be that's where a lot of the qualitative or so the research that is done at the small scale is done at some point along the journey there. Another school of thought is that smuggling is much more organized and that there are organized packages available at much higher cost. But when migrants buy into those packages, they could end up being in debt bondage for several years and much more likely to be exploited. A lot of this evidence seems to come from law enforcement rather than academic research. So it's not always clear what the various models are based upon. But there are these, if you look at recent reports by Europol or Interpol, you will see that these sorts of distinctions are suggested based on intelligence evidence.
Right. It was interesting to notice the payment method. It used to be the 100% upfront before you're smuggled. You pay the 100% upfront payment to the smugglers before you're smuggled to another country. These days, it's a 50%. You pay the 50% of the smuggling fees to your smuggler, and then the rest of the 50% will be paid at the end destination. These days, now it's a 0% upfront payment. You will be, if you're a smuggler, you'll be paid at the end destination. That's why the smugglers become more desperate. They're really focusing on how to, you know, the success rate of the smuggled migrants. So they're probably more sort of demand, supply, more sort of economic calculation or rationality of this whole smuggling industry. Do we have any sort of figure or understanding how big this smuggling industry is globally?
Yes, there are lots of figures, and I'll tell you how they're usually calculated. We usually have some information about the payments that people are likely to make, migrants are likely to make. So, for example, last year between Turkey and Greece, just to cross that between Turkey and Lesbos, a very short crossing, you could be paying between 500 to 2,500 euros. We don't know the exact figure. There might be different rates for adults and for children. So what people tend to do then is they take these sorts of figures, they look at the numbers of migrants who are crossing the Mediterranean or different parts of the world, and then they come up with a global figure. I mean, it's not 100% scientific or precise, but we end up then with enormous figures which give you a magnitude of the scale of the business. And in the case of Europe last year, it's said that maybe between 3 and 5 million euros, was was changing hands, and I think the figure for Asia is something in the region of, what was it, two billion or so? I don't know, you would know better than I, because you worked on the Asia chapter, but that is how these sorts of figures are developed and circulated. But clearly, it is a huge, a very, very lucrative business, doesn't really require a great deal of skill or infrastructure often, and you can make vast sums of money relatively quickly and easily.
Yeah, that's right. I only have an estimated figure, so I won't give the numbers to the audience, I'm sorry. Yeah. But it's a big billion-dollar industry. But what's also happening in Asia is that these smugglers are not working alone. It's not they're not working alone with the criminal gangs, but also often they work with the government, because some governments are corrupt. You bribe the border security, and then you will have a safe route to another country. So it's often the case in part of Southeast Asia. So what would you say your conclusion is out of the global report? Can we find any common characteristics of migrant smuggling globally?
Well, I think the first point to make is that it is a global phenomenon. And what is surprising is that you will see certain groups of migrants appearing in all over the world. And so we were surprised. You know, we brought together people from Latin America, from Africa, the Middle East, and they were sometimes talking about the same people from the same countries, even though this is a global report covering different regions of the world. I think in terms of where we go next, perhaps what's really important now is that there will be a global summit of world leaders in New York in September. And one of the, to discuss how the world should address large-scale movements of refugees and migrants in the future. And a key emphasis of that summit will be in promoting more safe migration and more orderly and regular migration. And what the UN Secretary General wants to do is to invite states to agree upon a new compact, a new global agreement to try and promote more safe migration. And that would imply also addressing migrant smuggling in a more systematic, vigorous manner across the globe. We have seen many different initiatives at national or regional level, but this is something new at the global level. Now, how that all develops remains an open question, because as you know, many countries around the world have very different views about migration today and about their how far they wish to share responsibility for addressing migration and refugee challenges. In terms of our report and where we go next, I think one thing that was particularly striking is that we live in a world where most of you in this room, and I'll reach out for it, you probably have one of these. So every time you use this, you're generating some data. And people, I mean, without me or you telling people where we are, somebody in this world knows when we cross an international border, or even when we move around within Australia, perhaps. So this is called, euphemistically, or big data. And we're told that in the last few years, more data has been generated through these new technologies than ever before. One thing that was missing in all the studies that we looked at on migrant smuggling, in the majority of cases, is that researchers and policymakers haven't really paid enough attention to the potential of looking at big data to understand migrant smuggling. And we all know, I mean, for example, that smugglers currently advertise their services on Facebook, or even, you know, or using other means. And there's a lot of interesting information that perhaps could be studied, used through by looking at the potential of exploiting better big data. Now, we know that there are problems as well, because there are concerns about personal security and confidentiality, etc. But that seemed to us one of the major gaps that we haven't really, the research community and policy community hasn't really caught up with the fact that we're living in a different age today than 5 years ago, let's say, or 10 years ago, when everybody wasn't walking around with a smartphone, for example.
So there's a great potential for further data analysis. Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Frank Lasko. It was a very comprehensive cover of global, not just global migrant smuggling, but and, you know, migration in general. Now I'll open up the floor for question and answers. When you raise your hand, please identify yourself, your name and affiliation, please.
Hi, so my name is Matthew Abbey, and I work at Human Rights Watch currently. With our work, we're kind of looking at the difference between trafficking and people smuggling. And I understand if it's trafficking, there's some sort of like material benefit involved. One of our problems is we can't identify what a material benefit actually is. And I'm wondering if you can offer any advice on what how to describe this term better in order to enhance our work.
Are we going to each one, or are we going to take a group of questions?
We'll go around the
Fine. Fine. Well, that's a very specific question. I can what I can tell you is that we in IOM have the only global trafficking database based on information collected from victims of trafficking, people that we assist. And we assist approximately one in seven of the world's victims of trafficking currently, according to our estimates, or one in six, I think. Now, I would imagine, and I don't have that information in front of me, but I would imagine that there is a rich source of information that we collect on each case of trafficking that where we assist someone that would provide some indication of how that person was trafficked and for what purpose and whether or not there was some material gain, what was the material gain involved. So your specific question is trying to prove that somebody what exactly would you like to prove? Where, can you give me a very concrete example of where you lacked?
The question question and answer. Yeah. Trafficking comes in three components, isn't it? One act of moving people either internally or cross-nationally, means of coercion or deception or omitting information, and finally, the purpose of exploitation. I'm not sure whether your question is about the material benefit for traffickers or people who are trafficked. Can you elaborate your question again?
I guess basically I forget which treaty your document it exactly is, but I was just reading before basically that in order for someone to be trafficked, there needs to be some sort of like material benefit. And I've, through further research online, it seems that there isn't really an answer to what material benefit really implies. So I was wondering if the IOM had some sort of kind of like definition on what a material benefit is.
Material benefit from the trafficked person's side.
So it could be financial or non-financial.
So people are normally trafficked because of there's an inducement of, you know, they are offered their better position, better paid job on the other side of the country or across the national borders. So they're normally either deceived or they're tricked into these trafficking routes. That's why they are moved to another country or another location. Any other question?
Hi, my name is Kira Shaw and I work at the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. I was wondering whether you'd had the opportunity to do any research on the reasons that people choose to go with people smugglers.
Okay. One more question over here from this gentleman.
Tony Dowling, College of Radiologists. What is the feedback from Germany right now after having accepted huge numbers of refugees? I mean, it must be a terribly difficult problem.
So I'll answer the first question first. And I think the first question is probably one of the most important reasons why we prepared the global report on migrant smuggling. And one of the most important things that we maybe need to look at more closely in the future, in my view. A lot of research on migrant smuggling tends to focus on law enforcement issues. How are the smuggling organisations organised? What routes do people take? How much money is involved? There's less of a focus on what's the migrant's view in all of this? Why is it that a small number of people choose to leave their countries and to pay somebody to help them to go somewhere? To give you an example, last year, about 25,000 Nigerians arrived in Europe out of the 1 million or so who arrived. Now, Nigeria has a population, I think, of around 170 million people. So 25,000 represents a very small proportion of the Nigerian population. Now, we hear a lot of talk about the need to combat poverty, terrorism, etc., etc., invest in development if you're going to stop people smuggling or address root causes. But I think we probably, and I think this is maybe missing from some of the research, we need more targeted research and more of a focus on specific groups within populations, and often they are people either living in certain regions, and it may not always be the poorest region. In the case of Nigeria, many of the people don't come from the poorest parts of the country. And it's often certain population groups. It may often be young males, although we've seen increasingly in the last year or two many children migrating. And I think we don't know enough about why some people, the minority usually, choose to move on. Often, another situation is first asylum countries. The majority of Syrians have not left Turkey or Jordan, but a minority have. And what are the distinctions between these different groups? I think that is where research can make a contribution, and we hope that our report would help to promote what we've sort of called in the jargon more migrant-centric research. But it's really trying to understand or give policymakers a better understanding of, you know, if you are sitting in Pakistan or Nigeria or Iraq, you know, how do you view the world? How do you view your opportunities? What really influences your choices? And if you do want to address this problem or this challenge and give people hope or give them alternatives, then it makes sense to understand better why some people in those countries, maybe a minority, are choosing to leave those countries. And I think we don't know enough about that. So I don't think there is a simple answer to that question. I think it's a very good question. The second question was about Germany. Yes, Germany, that's also a very interesting and delicate question. I live in Berlin, and I would say that probably last year when we opened our centre, which was in early September, there was a great deal of euphoria, as you know, and there were people at football stadiums saying we welcome refugees, and people giving out sweets at Munich railway station to refugees. The mood has certainly changed, and there have been some terrible incidents of racism and xenophobia and attacks on refugee centres. But I think overall, the government has taken a strong line in trying to push as hard as it can to promote the integration of those who have arrived, but also taking a hard line in saying those people who have not been accepted for asylum will be expected to go home. And that's the other policy challenge today. The government is saying, well, okay, now, you know, we have reviewed your case, and we would like to help you now to return to your country of origin. And that's that is one of the most difficult challenges, because there are, last year, in fact, it may be a surprise to many of you in this room, for the first half of last year, most of the asylum seekers in Germany were coming from Europe, from the Balkans, or the largest group were coming from the Balkans. And that changed with the arrival of more Syrians and Iraqis and Afghans. And now the situation is much more challenging. I think many of the Afghans, for example, are not being accepted for asylum. And now the challenge is to find a way to return some of those people.
German case is certainly an interesting one. Let me add to the first question. It's a great question, the reason or motivation for migrant smuggling. It's traditionally understood as economic, more employment opportunities, better economic chances, and education are the pull factor of migrant smuggling. There are also push factors, underdevelopment, and lack of education opportunities in your home country. But increasingly, the role of smugglers, or so-called facilitators, are very, very significant and important. For example, the Chinese smuggled migrant to U.S., 90% of them, or between 80 and 90% of the smuggled Chinese migrants to the U.S. are from Fujian, because it was all organized by a group of a very group of small individual smugglers who were organizing this movement, and another 80% from Wenzhou. They go to Italy. So there are certainly a traditional push and pull factors, but increasingly the role of the middleman or middlewoman is very important. And Frank is absolutely right. You need to have a focus group studies, because you can't really generalize the main motivations for smuggling, because they're very different from one group to another.
If I could add, we've just completed a review of research in this area for the European Asylum Support Office, which is based in Malta, and they wanted to know, you know, what do we learn from looking at the push and pull factors of migration? And we actually had a team that reviewed 500 different studies. Now, at the end of the day, I think the balance of the research will often say it's a mixture of different economic and social factors, et cetera, et cetera. But I still think we need different types of research that will hone in much more narrowly on particular groups and particular areas if we really want to understand better migrants' perspectives here. We also have to keep in mind that what happens in the destination countries will also have an impact on how many people arrive and what kinds of people arrive. If unaccompanied minors target certain countries in Europe, it's partly because of the nature of the asylum system and the benefits that they might be able to access in those countries. So there, you know, it works on both sides. Yeah.
It's very interesting. Smuggling is seen from the government as a criminal act. It's something has to be stopped or combated. Mm. But from migrants' perspective, or even smugglers' perspective, in case of China, it's definitely migrants understood smuggling as a way of social aspiration. It's difficult to climb up the social ladder in China, but through smuggling to another country, you can have better businesses and better life for the future generations, for example. So yeah, there's certainly different approach to migrant smuggling from government, from individuals, from smugglers and business societies. And we would like to understand through data analysis and further research.
I think you also have to keep in mind that countries have maybe different views. There's less of a consensus among countries about how to deal with migrant smuggling than there is perhaps in the case of trafficking. All countries in the world see trafficking as something that involves human rights abuses, terrible exploitation of migrants. Most countries don't want to see their nationals trafficked anywhere. But in the case of smuggling, countries may have different views. They may actually think that it's a good thing for their citizens to go abroad and to be able to send money back home. And because there are no legal channels available for their citizens to move to another country, smuggling is the only option. But nonetheless, from the country of origin perspective, the developing country, they may think that that's a good thing to have more of their people abroad, because there's high unemployment at home, and those people abroad can help to promote links between the countries and send back remittances. Yeah.
Exactly.
But that makes it a more difficult conversation when it comes to trying to find joint approaches to combating migrant smuggling than maybe human trafficking.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. Some many cases, migrant smuggling is the only way to get out of the country. If there is no further question, okay, please. Yeah.
Andrew Caldor, I wonder if there isn't a better word than smuggling. Thinking of the people that were going from Turkey to Greece when the borders were open, In what sense was that being smuggled? You know, we talk about altruistic smugglers. You know, you think of the slave railway in the South, in the US, Civil War, you know, the Jews in Europe. There's so much altruism involved in smuggling and such a mix of motives in the process. And the distinction, you have to go from a travel agent to a facilitator to a person who helps provide a rubber boat to desperate people. I wonder if an institute like the IOM, with its prestige, couldn't come up with a better word that didn't have all the ugly political associations of smuggling.
That's an excellent question.
Well, I kind of alluded to this when talking about the European debate. There is a distinction made in Europe whereby states do recognise that sometimes people are smuggled on humanitarian grounds. So the examples you gave are about people who have no other option in order to flee, to find safety. They're going to have to pay someone to cross the border. And we've seen this throughout history. In fact, my own parents, when they left Hungary in 1956, they paid somebody to help them cross the border into Austria. But in the Cold War period, they were welcomed, and they were not treated badly by any means, and they were encouraged to, you know, integrate in. They're almost regarded as heroes because they left the communist system. So there are, you know, I think there's definitely an issue, I think, about terminology, and you're right to say that the word smuggling is regarded at least face value as a very pejorative term. As I said right from the beginning, when we started this approach, and I have to say this project partly started when our director general met with one of the senior Australian scholars, Anne Gallagher, who I think is she based here in Sydney or somewhere close by, and we had a conversation about this whole subject, and there was a general feeling that we've been making, or the international community for too long has been making simple distinctions between migrants caught up in trafficking, migrants caught up in smuggling, and we're not paying enough attention to the fact that the migrants involved in smuggling activities around the world are facing terrible hardships, and we need to be doing much more to protect vulnerable migrants, even if they might not be officially defined as refugees, and that we need to be addressing this issue, not only because people are crossing borders illegally, but there are terrible abuses of people's rights. And we need to be simply doing more on humanitarian grounds. So that was kind of our starting point. But I'll take the point that you make back to Berlin and to Geneva and see what we can come up with. But certainly terminology is something that is discussed a great deal among the research community, and there isn't always There are differences in the ways in which smuggling is defined, although we do have a sort of international official definition based on the Palermo protocols, but there has been some refinement over the years, and particularly I think the people working with refugees are very concerned about what options people really have in these situations. That's a good point.
That's a really good point. People are smuggled because there are often no other legal means to go to another country, so they use smugglers. And one more anecdote from my own research. You ask smuggled migrants, why did you use smugglers? Because it's easy, it's quicker, it will only take a few days or even a few weeks. If you want to use the legal channel, it will take 122 weeks. We have to fill out forms, which I don't understand. I'm not educated. I can't read legal documents. It's very cumbersome to go to the capital to apply for the forms and get the responses. It's longer. It's very cumbersome. Whereas using smugglers who's living in your village, you can go to another country in a few weeks' time. So from migrants' perspective, the smuggling is probably a word or something we have to consider more sort of ethical migrants' perspective. Okay, thank you so much. And thank you so much, Dr. Frank Raxo, for coming to the LOE to give us very comprehensive understanding about migrant smuggling globally. Thank you very much.